Hello, and welcome to the Freedom Writers Podcast, a show about education and how it can change the world. I'm your host, Erin Gruwell, and this is Episode 3, A Mission and a Mandate. Whether you're an educator, a parent, a mentor, or a student, our purpose is to engage, enlighten, and empower you to make a difference. I am positively giddy. Today, we have the privilege of hearing two original Freedom Writers, that's R-I-D-E-R, by the name of John Lewis and Jim Zwerg, who inspired the Freedom Writers of the 90s. This episode is going to be looking at what inspired them to stand up for freedom, equality, and for social justice. First, we'll hear from Congressman John Lewis, an excerpt from a live speech he gave to the Freedom Writers and Freedom Writer teachers at a symposium we hosted in Washington, D.C. He tells us about his humble origins, dreams of being a preacher, about meeting Dr. Martin Luther King, and about getting into good trouble. Following Congressman Lewis's speech, we have the perfect diary of the day, where one of my Freedom Writers will read an excerpt from the Freedom Writers' diary about the origin of our name in honor of those activists. Lastly, our featured discussion today is with another Freedom Writer, Jim Zwerg. Jim sat beside John Lewis when they were both college students at Fisk University. They boarded that bus in Nashville, headed for Montgomery, Alabama. And Jim takes us to that exact moment the doors open and his fate changed forever. You won't want to miss it. Thank you so much for listening to today's show. As you listen to these stories, I invite you to ponder, what is it that you are willing to get into trouble for? If the Freedom Writers from the 1960s could ride buses to fight segregation, then why can't we pick up a pen and write a different ending to a different story? Here he is, original Freedom Writer, civil rights icon, and now Congressman John Lewis.
Thank you so much. I'm honored to be here. I'm pleased to be here. Now, I didn't grow up in a big city like St. Louis, Boston, Chicago, Atlanta, or New York, or Los Angeles. I grew up in rural Alabama, about 50 miles from Montgomery, outside of a little place called Troy. My father was a sharecropper, a tenant farmer. My great-grandfather had been a slave. 1944, when I was 4 years old, and I do remember when I was four. How many of you remember when you were four? What happened to the rest of us? But in 1944, when I was only 4 years old, my father had saved $300. And with the $300, he bought 110 acres of land. 110 acres of land for $300. My family still owns this land today. On this farm, we raise a lot of cotton and corn, peanuts, hogs, cows, and chickens. I don't eat too many peanuts today, but if you come by my congressional office over in the Cannon Building, the first thing the staff will offer you will be some peanuts. Because in the state of Georgia, we raise a lot of peanuts like we raised in Alabama. I ate so many peanuts during the 40s and the 50s, I just don't want to see any more peanuts. And you heard me say we raised a lot of chickens. Growing up there on the farm, it was my responsibility to care for the chickens. And I fell in love with raising chickens like no one else could raise chickens. Any of you know anything about raising chickens? Oh, well, why don't we compare notes here? But as a little child, about 8 or 9 years old, I wanted to be a minister. I wanted to preach the gospel. So from time to time, with the help of my brothers and sisters and cousins, we would gather all of our chickens together in the chicken yard, like together here in the hall. The chicken would help make up the audience, along with my brothers and sisters and cousins. And I would start speaking or preaching, and when I look back or look around, the chicken would start bobbing their head, shaking their head. They never quite said amen. But Dick and Patrick, I'm convinced that some of those chickens that I preached to in the 40s and the 50s, tended to listen to me much better than some of my colleagues listened to me today in the Congress. Well, that's enough of that story. When we would visit the little town of Troy, visit Montgomery, visit Tuskegee, I saw those signs that said white men, colored men, white women, colored waiting. I would come home and ask my mother, my father, my grandparents, my great-grandparents, why? They would say, that's the way it is. Don't get in the way. Don't get in trouble. You go downtown on a Saturday afternoon to the theater. All of us little black children had to go upstairs to the balcony. And all the little white children went downstairs to the first floor. I kept saying, why? That's the way it is. Don't get in the way. Don't get in trouble. But I heard about Rosa Parks in 1955 when I was 15 years old in the 10th grade. Heard about Martin Luther King Jr. Heard him on our radio speaking. Met Rosa Parks in 1957, at the age of 17. The next year, I met Martin Luther King Jr. I was so inspired that I wanted to get in the way, to get in trouble. I got in trouble. Good trouble, necessary trouble. As teacher, I want to thank you for teaching. But we also must teach our young people, all of our young people. And it doesn't matter whether they're black or white, Latino, Asian American, Native American, they must be encouraged to get in trouble, to stand up, to speak up and speak out. We will talk, we learned during the early days of the Civil Rights Movement, when you see something that is not right, not fair, not just, you got to do something about it. You have a moral obligation, a mission, and a mandate to do something about it. I remember in 1956, at the age of 16, so inspired by Rosa Parks, so inspired by Dr. King, that with some of my brothers and sisters and cousins, we went down to the public library, trying to get library cards, trying to check out some books. And we were told by the librarian that the libraries are whites only and not for colors. I went back to that same public library on July 5th, 1998, for a book signing of my first book, Walking with the Wind. And hundreds of blacks and white citizens showed up. End of the program, they gave me a library card. As a young student, I wanted to attend a little college called Troy State College. It is now known as Troy University, only 10 miles from my home. Submitted my application, my high school transcript. I never heard a word from the college. I didn't tell my mother, my father, any of my sisters or brothers, any of my teachers. I just did it. So you know what I did? When I was 17, I wrote a letter to Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., told him I needed his help. Dr. King wrote me back and sent me a round-trip Greyhound bus ticket and invited me to come to Montgomery to meet with him. In the meantime, I had been accepted at a little college in Nashville, Tennessee. An uncle of mine gave me a $100 bill, gave me one of those upright foot lockers, you know, the big trunks. I put everything that I had except my chicken in that foot locker. And took a Greyhound bus to Nashville, Tennessee. And after being there for about 3 weeks, I told one of my teachers that I'd been in contact with Dr. King. This teacher knew Dr. King. They had studied together at Morehouse College in Atlanta. So he informed Dr. King that I was there. Martin Luther King Jr. got back in church and suggested when I was home for spring break to come and see him. So in March of 1958, by this time I'm 18 years old, I boarded a bus, I traveled to Nashville, to Montgomery, rather. And a young lawyer, never seen a lawyer before, by the name of Fred Gray, who was a lawyer for Rosa Parks, for the Montgomery Movement, and became our lawyer during the Freedom Rides and during the march from Selma to Montgomery. met me at the Greyhound bus station, and drove me to the First Baptist Church in downtown Montgomery, passing by the Reverend Ralph Abernathy, and ushered me into the office of the church. Now, so Martin Luther King Jr. and Ralph Abernathy standing behind a desk. I was so scared, I didn't know what to say or what to do. And Dr. King said, "Are you the boy from Troy? Are you John Lewis?" And I said, "Dr. King, I am John Robert Lewis." And he started calling me the boy from Troy. And it was there that I made a decision that I couldn't turn back. I first came to Washington, D.C., May 1st, 1961. Had all of my hair, a few pounds lighter, 21 years old, the same year that Barack Obama was born. Just think, in 1961, black people and white people couldn't board a Greyhound bus together. Here in Washington, D.C., be seated together, travel through Virginia, through North Carolina, South Carolina, Georgia, Alabama, Mississippi, on our way to New Orleans to test a decision of the United States Supreme Court. We were beaten, left bloody, and left unconscious, left in a pool of blood in Rock Hill, South Carolina. A mob beat us in Montgomery at the Greyhound bus station. We didn't give up. We didn't become bitter. We didn't become hostile. Many of us had accepted the way of peace, the way of love, the way of nonviolence, as a way of life, as a way of living. We must teach our young people the way of peace, the way of love, the way of nonviolence. My seatmate on the Greyhound bus that arrived in Rock Hill, South Carolina, was a young white gentleman. The two of us got off the bus, started in a so-called white waiting room. Members of the Klan beat us, left us lying in a pool of blood on May 9th, 1961. 7 years later, to be exact, February 09, one of the guys that beat us came to Capitol Hill in his 70s with his son. Son was in his 40s. And said, "Mr. Lewis, I'm one of the people that beat you. I want to apologize. Will you forgive me?" His son started crying. He started crying. They hugged me. I hugged them back. I said, "I accept your apology and I forgive you." That is the power of the way of love. Power of the way of nonviolence. We have to create the beloved community where we respect the dignity and the worth of every human being. That's what the Civil Rights Movement was all about. You can do it. You must do it. We cannot say that we cannot do it. We can do it. We can do it. We did it during the Mississippi summer. We did it during Selma. America is a different America. And if some people say nothing has changed, I feel like saying, come and walk in my shoes. The signs that I saw in Alabama, in Georgia, in Mississippi, in Tennessee, that said white waiting, color waiting, white men, color men, those signs are gone. And they will not return. The only places our children will see those signs will be in a book, on a video, or in a museum. So we have an obligation to tell the story and give people this sense of hope and optimism. I'm very hopeful about the future. We have a lot of work to do. We're not there yet. The late A. Philip Randolph, said on one occasion, maybe our foremothers and our forefathers all came to this great land in different ships, but we're all in the same boat now. So we got to look out for each other and care for each other. The way of love, the way of peace, the way of nonviolence is a better way. Thank you so much for all that you do. Find a way to get in the way. Find a way to redeem the soul of America. Find a way to help create the beloved community, a community at peace with itself. We can do it. Let's do it.
The Freedom Writers and the Freedom Writer teachers were so honored by those words, and immediately following this incredible presentation, we marched hand in hand to the Library of Congress, and we delivered books written by their students, students who want to find a way for love, peace, and justice. Our symposiums are a way to curate content and bring like-minded people together to instruct, to inspire each and every one of us to make a difference. That's why we're here. The Foundation is here to serve you in any way we can, to empower you to help all students, your sons, your daughters, anyone in your community, to reach their fullest potential. If you'd like to learn more about our symposiums, our teacher trainings, or any of the live events we do anywhere around the country, follow us on Facebook at Freedom Writers Foundation, or check out our website at freedomwritersfoundation.org. We want to connect with you. It's time for our Diary of the Day, where a freedom writer named Shanita Jones reads diary number 75 from our book, The Freedom Writer's Diary.
Dear Diary, I feel like I finally have a purpose in this class and in life. That purpose is to make a difference and to stand up for a cause. Ms. G showed us a video during Black History Month about a group of civil rights activists in the 1960s. They decided to challenge segregation in the South. Rather than boycott buses, they took their challenge a step further. They integrated their bus and traveled from Washington, D.C. through the Deep South. They were called the Freedom Riders, and they wanted the world to know that change was necessary and that being tolerant of each other is good. I was impressed that Jim Zwerg, a white man, had made the choice to be on the bus when he didn't have to. He was white and could sit anywhere he wanted and risk everything when he didn't have to. He wanted to fight for others who didn't have the same privileges or rights as he did. I'm sure that because of Jim's choice of riding the bus with black people, a lot of his peers might have thought he was crazy. He didn't have to, so why get himself into trouble? At the end of the video, somebody suggested that we name ourselves the Freedom Writers in honor of the Freedom Writers. Why not? It's perfect. But those are huge shoes to fill. So if we're going to take their name, we better take their courage and conviction. It's one thing to ride a bus, but they eventually had to get off and face the music. So it's one thing for us to write diaries, but if we want to be like the Freedom Writers, we need to take the extra step. Now, when I write, I'll remember Jim's work and what he risked his life for. Like him, I am willing to step forward, unafraid of who or what lies ahead. After all, history tells me that I am not alone.
I love how that freedom writer picked up a pen and was able to paint a picture about Jim Zwerg's courage and how it was an inspiration for us to take our name, our motto, and our message in homage of them. So it is so apropos that our featured discussion today is with that extraordinary man. He came from very humble roots, and yet, in his journey and his quest to make a difference, he inspired a legacy. Joining us by phone today is the courageous Jim Zwerg. It is an honor to be interviewing a personal hero of myself and the Freedom Writers, Jim Zwerg, an original Freedom Writer. Welcome, Jim.
Thank you.
As a young man growing up in Appleton, Wisconsin, can you explain where your sense of activism came from?
I would say three areas influenced me. Number one, my parents. Had a very loving home. We grew up in the church. And in our family, I cannot ever remember my parents making a derogatory statement about anyone of another faith, race, etc. We were taught respect for one another. My dad was a dentist. He was a professional man. He would give a day of free dental work once a month for those who couldn't afford it. You know, here was a wonderful experience of kindness and giving and sharing. That's the kind of home I grew up in. The second thing I think that I know influenced me greatly was my involvement in the Boy Scouts of America. I joined the Cub Scouts at about 8 years old and went through Cub Scouts, Boy Scouts, Explorers. I attained my Eagle Scout. I took scouting very, very seriously. When I considered the words of the oath and the law, I took those words to heart and lived by them. And I guess the last thing I would say was the church itself. And we grew up in the church, you know, the Sunday school whole bit, and sang in church choirs and was an acolyte and so forth. Probably began after my scouting when I was a senior in high school. I was the president of the youth group. It was a fairly large church. I would have 65 kids, I think, around in our youth group. And our associate minister was a very wonderful pastor. He had taken me under his wing as far as letting me go to hospital visitations with him and home visitations. And so I got to see him in service to others, and the gift he had of the sensitivity and meeting their needs. That was where I first began even thinking about the ministry. He had integrated his little rural church before he became our associate minister, and he was a strong advocate of saying, you know, kids, you got to live your faith. You know, you hear the Sunday school stories, you know, you got to put your faith to work in your lives. So I think I'd have to say those three elements, my family, Boy Scouts, and the church, were instrumental in giving me the crux of my ethics and my beliefs in dealing with other people and so forth.
I think that's really evident when you went to Beloit College in Wisconsin and your first roommate was an African-American, a young gentleman that unfortunately faced injustice and inequality. Can you share what it was like to watch firsthand some of the things that your roommate Robert Carter experienced?
Well, the very first night, my folks were going to take us out to dinner, and we went to a very nice restaurant and ordered and waited. And finally, the maitre d' whispered in my dad's ear. And my dad said, excuse me, folks, but we're all leaving. They had refused to serve Bob. So we found another place to eat. But that, I mean, that was the initial. But just witnessing the verbal and physical abuse that Bob encountered, you know, comments just loud enough to hear, I smell a gar, not a cigar, an egar, type thing like that. During intramural sports, somebody would trip him, hit him, you know, foul him way too aggressively, trying to hurt him. Or going into town where we might not be served, he had a heck of a time finding anybody to give him a haircut. We go over to the commissary and, you know, get our trays and go to sit down. People get up and leave the table. I made a mistake of pledging a fraternity to when they discovered it was segregated and he couldn't come into the house, so I gave him their pin back. But that sort of thing. And the thing was, with Bob, he never responded in kind, out verbally or physically, at any of the folks that did this. And I took him to task on this because I had a short-term temper. I just, you know, Bob, why don't you do this? Why do you take this crap? And Bob is the one that introduced me to Dr. King's book. He went over to his dresser and took it out. He had a copy. And he said, read it, and then we'll talk.
Jim, I think what is amazing is, as a young college student, you made the conscious choice to go to Fisk University in Nashville, Tennessee. For our listeners, at that time, that was predominantly an African-American college. And you arrive at Fisk University and befriend John Lewis. Can you describe how your friendship and solidarity towards justice grew?
Well, when I went to Fisk the very first day, I went to the Union and got a hamburger and a shake or something, but a young couple invited me to join them in their booth. And there were, you know, the jukebox was playing and kids were dancing and stuff. And introduced ourselves and got talking and just having a delightful time. The twist was in. Let me tell you, the Midwestern twist was very different from the Fisk University twist. But I proceeded to go out on the floor and make an ass out of myself. But we had a wonderful time. And we were just enjoying so much. When I was company, I thought, how about we take in a movie this afternoon? And they said, well, Jim, we can't go to a movie together. The movie theaters are segregated in Nashville. We can't sit together. We couldn't use the same I was dumbfounded when I heard that. And these two kids who've been involved in the sit-ins the previous year that had integrated a number of the lunch counters, and they invited me. They said there was going to be a meeting that night, and they were about to start a whole new campaign to integrate the movie theaters. So they invited me to meet with them, and I went and I listened and learned that there was going to be a demonstration on the following Saturday, and I could go down on the bus and watch it, and I did that. I watched for about a half an hour. There were about a dozen kids standing in front of this movie theater. The fellows were all in suits, the gals were in dresses, very not like they were going on a date. No placards, no freedom songs, just standing there. You know, there were a few hecklers, but nothing big. And I finally went across the street and went to the person in the back of the line and introduced myself and said, you know, what are you trying to accomplish? Because I don't see that anything is really being accomplished. Well, this person referred me to their spokesman at the demonstration, and I went over, and that was John Lewis. That's how I met John Lewis. John invited me to come back to the church that the demonstration was going to be ending. And if I wanted to follow them back to the church, he'd be happy to talk to me. So I went and followed them back to the church and was absolutely amazed, almost in awe. I mean, John is about 6 months younger than I am, but I had never met anyone my age who was so together. John has a slight speech impediment, but boy, when John spoke, everybody shut up and listened. His commitment to nonviolence was beyond question. His faith was just incredible. And I'm sitting there talking to him, and he's telling me about the power of nonviolence and that love is the eternal motif of nonviolence, and that kind of love remains giving and forgiving even in the presence of violence. And just being in the presence of these other kids, like John, like Bernard Lafayette, like Jim Bevel, like Diane Nash, who were all principal players in the youth movements of the movement. Those names were part of it, and they were part of the leadership in Nashville. That's the environment that I was involved with. The spirit, the camaraderie, the depth of love. We drew our strength from one another. We knew that there was a power working in us and through us. When we sang, "We shall overcome," we believed it. I would go back to my dorm and I'd reread whatever passages, prayed a lot about it, and finally it just hit me that the gospel, the story of Jesus of Nazareth, is the most powerful story about nonviolent direct action ever written. His whole ministry was about love, was about friendship and understanding. It certainly was his way of life. He chose love over hate. He believed in innocent suffering could educate and transform. Another one of the principles on nonviolence. And he knew that the universe was on the side of justice. Those are basically the same principles of nonviolence. And it just hit me. And I said, bam, that's it. And at that moment, I decided nonviolence is going to be my way of life. And I'm going to get actively involved in this program. Then I started really actively getting involved in the workshops until they felt I was ready. You didn't just go down and demonstrate. You had to prove through the workshops, and these were very intense workshops. You could be spit on, kicked, hit, whatever, because they wanted to make sure that you would not break in a situation of violence. And ultimately, I was invited to be a participant in the demonstrations.
So you're going to workshops, you're reading and being inspired by those that are believing that the universe is about love and justice. And they gave you an opportunity to not just stand idly by, but to do something. Can you describe what that was like when you were given a task and you did it?
Well, I was basically the only white fella that was actively involved in the movement at that time. There were some of the girls actually from Nashville, some white gals that were over at Vanderbilt and Peabody that were involved. And then there were a couple of the exchange students like myself. But the simple thing for me was there were four movie theaters in four blocks downtown Nashville. And since they didn't know me at this point, I had participated in some sit-ins where, you know, some of the lunch counters had reneged, and so we'd go down, and again, I could get, you know, a hamburger and fries and coffee or shake or whatever, and once I was served, I just pass it around, cut my hamburger in four pieces and pass it around to the black kids that would suddenly come and sit down. So I had that advantage of where I could get the food. And the same thing went true at the movie theaters. I could go up and buy two tickets. I was paired with a young fellow by the name of Bill Harbor, who was from Tennessee State. And our goal, of course, once we had the tickets, was to get into the theater. Now, ultimately, I was able to buy six sets of tickets. But we never got inside to see a movie. The very first time we got into the lobby, and the manager had some, whatever you want to call them, tufts or whatever, in there, and we got cold cocked. The kids outside said they saw monkey wrenches, but we both got beaned and thrown back out on the sidewalk. And that was my introduction. That was basically one of my first demonstrations.
It was 1961 when these freedom rides started to challenge the horrific laws of segregation. I want you to describe why and how you chose to be on that bus.
China kept us abreast when he first got the information about the Freedom Rides. One bus was burned and firebombed in Anniston, and the other folks were beaten in Birmingham. And when this happened, he was back in Nashville. We had an emergency meeting. We had just successfully integrated the movie theaters. We were actually having a picnic. We were celebrating. And that's when we heard that the one bus had been bombed and that Jim Pike and persons had been beaten. And we held this immediate meeting and, you know, we need to let these people know that we're behind them. We sent a telegram down to Birmingham because at that point, Kennedy had sent John Sigenthaler to Birmingham to try to get the core people to quit. And he was successful in convincing them to do that. The state refused to provide any kind of security for the core riders. And even the one time they got them, they thought they were going to be on a plane, but then there was a bomb threat. And I mean, the police, even as they stood alongside, were making cruel, mean comments to the core riders. And they quit. And when we heard that the core riders had abandoned the ride, we met immediately and said, we've got to continue the ride. Because if you leave the message with the segregationists that all they've got to do is increase the violence, that you're going to turn tail and run, my heavens, that could set back the civil rights movement decades, literally. We saw that. We realized that. And what was logical to us, since we were experienced and dedicated, the most committed kids in Nashville that had proven themselves, it was logical that we would be the ones to continue the ride. So that decision was very quick. But then we had all of the logistics questions. Where should we go? Birmingham, or the next spot was Montgomery. How many should go? What should be the makeup? Where are we going to get the money for the tickets? It's the week before finals. What are we going to do about school? I mean, all these questions had to be dealt with. So I had to go to my professors and the dean of students to see if they would let me make up those finals if I lived through this. And they agreed to do this. Now, Fisk is a private university. The kids that went to, like, Tennessee State were all expelled. Out of the 24, about 18 of us, I'd say, volunteered to go. I realized that since the core ride had been integrated, it was imperative that continuing the group that continued the ride be integrated. So I volunteered. But the other element of that was I had also experienced in Nashville that I tended to be the focus of violence when it did occur in Nashville, and I would surely be the focus when we got to Birmingham or wherever. And one of the things that was discussed at great length was the possibility of our being killed, and that we needed to understand that and accept that. And we were encouraged to put down in writing something to our loved ones and to leave that with Diane Nash
for your parents back in Appleton, Wisconsin, what was their reaction? Did they want you to come home? Did they want you to fight harder?
The night before we left, I called them. I had written a statement to them. I'm probably to blame to a degree because my dad had his first coronary when I was a sophomore in high school. And he had, by the time I was a junior in college, had a couple of strokes and several more coronaries. So I purposely did not tell them of the level of my involvement. I mean, knowing that my life had been threatened in Nashville with a knife at my throat and stuff like this, they didn't need to hear that, you know. But realizing that if someone was going to die during this, it was very likely that it would be me. I felt I had to call them and just tell them how much I love them and thank them for being the kind of parents they were and instilling in my brother and myself that basic faith in mankind and goodness and love and respect for one another. And I mean, they were the ones that taught it to us, that showed us by example. And I just felt I needed to tell them, you know, thank you, I love you, I hope I'm going with your blessings. I did not get a chance to talk to my dad. I got a chance to talk to my mom, and she was extremely upset. She did not want me to go, feared for both not myself, but also her husband. You know, I was torn with their saying, you know, you can't go, you can't do this. Because I'd grown up respecting my parents and their rules. I mean, mom and dad said this, well, you did this. But I couldn't do it in this situation. I guess God's power was more important to me at that point. I said, this is God's will, Mom. I know I am doing His will. I've never been so sure of anything in my life. And she finally just said, well, you've killed your father, and hung up on me.
Jim, I have this iconic image of you and John Lewis that is now actually part of our upcoming documentary. It is a powerful picture. You were bloody and beaten. You were accosted by the mob in Montgomery, but you were the one who volunteered to be one of the first people off that bus. Can you paint a picture for our listeners of that moment?
Sure. There were about 21 of us that night, and John and I sat next to one another. John was by the window, and I was by the seat, and we were like two seats behind the bus driver. And I mean, they just hauled. The guy put the pedal to the metal, and we just flew down, and we arrived in Montgomery beforehand. Now, Floyd Mann had told the governor he would provide security for us from Birmingham to Montgomery. And L.B. Sullivan, the Montgomery police commissioner, vowed that he would provide security for us once we got to Montgomery. Well, on the trip, I mean, there were helicopters and fixed-wing planes going over. There were motorcycle cops. There were policemen in their squad cars. We could see submachine guns in the back seats. You know, people along the road shaking their arms at us and fists and stuff like that. But it was basically a very pleasant ride. This is mid-May in Alabama. The flowers were beautiful. The green was coming to the trees. John fell asleep while we were riding. This was Mother's Day Sunday. When we finally got to the Montgomery city limits, the thing that hit us first was, whoops, what happened to the police escort? It disappeared. And there were no Montgomery police anywhere to be seen. Now, the closer we got to the bus terminal, the more we realized that there was practically no vehicular traffic and no pedestrian traffic. As we pulled into the bus station, Catherine Burke saw a squad car pulling out and pointed it out to us. John was our spokesman, and when we arrived, he and I were the first two off the bus. And there were a few press people there, and they had a mic set up. And one of the things that you got to remember with the Klan is they don't mind having pictures of the after effect. but they sure don't want any pictures taken during. John was just about to step up to the mic, and this fellow, he grabbed the mic out of one of the guy's hands, threw it to the ground, stomped on it, and went after a photographer, after his camera. And he was grappling with the camera and threw the guy to the ground, and I think that was probably the cue, because then the mob came. They had not been visible when we arrived, but they came up the driveways and around the bus bays, just screaming at the top of their lungs, get them, get them, kill them, get the niggers. And of course, I could also hear, get the nigger lover. And you could see hammers, pipes, and chains, and hammer handles. I mean, everybody seemed to be holding something, coming at us, just screaming. And I bowed my head, and I asked God to be with me. And I asked him to help me to remain nonviolent. And I asked him to forgive them. And in that instant, I was grabbed and pulled over a railing, thrown to the ground, was able to get on all fours, and that's when I was kicked in my spine and my vertebrae were broken. Flew forward, fell on my back, and a foot came down in my face, and I was unconscious. I was in the hospital for like 5.5 days. I don't know if I was aware or not. I had a significant concussion, but I don't remember ever really having a doctor sit down and tell me, these are your injuries. I know I had just an incredible backache, but I remember basically nothing about the first 2.5 days in the hospital. And the one nurse told me that first night, she'd actually gave me a sleeping pill, put me out because there was a group that got within a half a block that were coming to lynch me. Wow. My dad asked our associate minister to come down and accompany me back home. When I got back home, number one, I had to reconcile with my parents as best I could, and a number of organizations like the Lions Club, Kiwanis, etc., wanted to hear the story, and I wanted to share it. So I did some speaking, but there were some injuries, like broken thumbs and some stuff like this, that contusions and all. It took like 2 weeks to heal. And then my brother drove back down to Fisk with me to take my final. My back hurt all the way down there. We had a Nash Rambler, and the seat, I lay on my back all the way down to Nashville. I was in such pain. Well, by the time I got to Nashville, all the kids in the Central Committee were already in jail down in Jackson. I was feeling incredibly guilty because I wasn't with them. I didn't realize the extent of the injuries to my back. And that came to me in a very real way the first day I went to take my finals. I stepped off the curb wrong and basically collapsed. Some students that were there carried me across to Meharry Medical College, which was right next door. That's when they discovered that I had these 3 cracked vertebrae. Said, you know, you're going nowhere. You know, you need to recuperate. You're not physically able to continue. Because I wanted to go on. I wanted to be with my brothers and sisters. I really felt that I had let them down. I quit. They were going on. They were continuing the ride, and I wasn't. And I felt that way for a long time, probably almost until the 40th anniversary. Can I share that story with you?
Sure.
Well, on the 40th anniversary, we went to the Birmingham Civil Rights Institute, and those of us who were there were singing freedom songs, and all of a sudden, this screen came on, like a 6-foot by 6-foot screen, and it's the interview with me from the hospital bed, where I'm saying, you know, we're going to continue to ride. I may not be able to go, but we're going to keep coming until we can ride anywhere. When I gave that, I don't remember doing it. Somebody else was guiding those words. And I just lost it. I just started crying and saying, you know, this is wrong. I don't deserve this. It shouldn't be me up there. I didn't go on to Jackson. I didn't spend 6 months in prison. I only had a couple of days, you know. The kids went on, proceeded to go into voter registration, and the Selma, you know, John on the Edwin Pettus bridge getting damn near killed. And there was this big fella, Jim Davis. He probably was 6'6", and probably 260. And he came over and he put his arm around me. And he said, "Brother Jim, what's the matter?" I, you know, was sobbing and saying, I shouldn't be here. I don't deserve this. And he took me by my shoulders and he looked me in the eye. And he said, "Jim, it was that message from the hospital bed that activated all the rest of us. It was your call to action that we responded to. You definitely deserve to be here." And he hugged me and we just cried together. And I guess I realized at that point, yeah, I was in life and I guess I had made a difference my own way.
Jim, I admire your humility. You gave a rallying cry then that galvanized the movement. If you could give a rallying cry to our youth and to teachers and to parents, what would that rallying cry be today?
When there's so many unsung heroes. We were 24 of us that were on the Central Committee in Nashville, but there were 400 young people that would show up in our various demonstrations that were committed to being there, to putting their lives on the line when we would go down and demonstrate. And that was just Nashville. That was communities all over the country. We realized, as John has said many times, we were trying to save the soul of our country. And we made a difference. We brought about change. Unfortunately, there's some pushback on that. Discriminations right now, I mean, there's still much to be done. Let me finish with just the admonition that Gandhi gave. He reminded people, become the change you want to see in the world. Don't sit back and let somebody else do it. You become the change. You find the issue. You stand up. You get involved. As John says, get in the way. There's a good way to get in the way.
In honor of their truth, may we all accept our own mission and mandate. This concludes our show this week. This episode was produced and edited by Bryce Sirier with production assistance from Clay Amontorp and Carolyn Crosby. If you enjoyed the show, please share it with your friends and leave us a review. Help us spread the word, share hope, and most importantly, help us pass the message of freedom so that we can lift, we can learn, and we can live our stories to the fullest. Our call to action today is this: may we get into trouble, may we spread peace, and may we be reminded that we are brothers and sisters on the same boat now. Until next time, dear listeners, may you write what needs to be written and tell what needs to be told.